I think I may be the only woman on the face of the earth that does not like going to the hairdresser. I confess that I have a very tender head. I don't know the little follicle things that are there. Every time I go, the gal goes, "This is ridiculous. You're the only person that comes here, spends all this money, and hates it." And it's true. It hurts. The last time I was in there, I had an interesting conversation with her that is a great introduction to today's lesson. And her son had married a gal of a, we'll call it a different faith. And my hairdresser is a Christian. She came to know the Lord years ago through, in fact, my friend Barb led her to Christ right there in her salon. But at any rate, her son married someone of a different faith, and kids were being raised in it. And the other day, when I was in there, she said to me, "You know, here's the problem. They're great people. They take care of their own. They do tremendous things by way of preparation for society. Their kids are so involved with evangelism and discipleship and commitment. What is the matter with us Christians? What's lacking?" And I laughed and I said, "Well, the problem is that we live too much in grace. We just need a good old healthy dose of law." And theologically, what I was trying to say was, you and I live in a world where we are grateful and motivated by the fact that God has given us, through the process of His Son's death and resurrection, all that we need for salvation and for sanctification. It's all by grace. I didn't earn it. I don't get it. It's not my function that provided it. And therefore, there is in Christendom a lack of urgency to participate in some of the things that might be true in this other group. They're still trying to earn it. They're still trying to get it. And the problem is, it's kind of like the difference between salvation and sanctification. And those of you that have been a Christian a while understand the difference between those two things. On the one hand, it's the act by which God declares you or I righteous because of His Son. Because of what Jesus has done on the cross and through His resurrection and the life that He now lives and the seating of Himself at the right hand of the Father, you and I have, in essence, a passport that's been stamped. Now, I didn't earn that. I didn't get it by my functions or the items that I did. I didn't go on 15 missions and I didn't give X number of dollars or provided these kinds of services to the poor. I put myself in a place to accept what Jesus Christ had done for me, and therefore in Him I became declared righteous. Grace. So that's salvation. Then we get to the living out of that, and we call that sanctification. And sometimes, as Christians, we confuse that. And I was thinking of an illustration of that as it relates to my coming trip to Europe. You know, you go and you make sure that you have a passport. You know, nowadays you can't travel overseas unless your passport's at least 6 months in advance. They don't like you traveling with a passport that has less than 6 months of duration on it. But I looked at mine, and mine had years and years, and so I got it out and wanted to make sure, you know, I wasn't within the 6 month, and yeah, I got, I don't know, 5 more years or 6 more years on my passport. You open it up to the front page, and it's stamped right there in the middle, citizen of the United States of America. And it's the right color, and it's got the right stamp on it. And it doesn't really matter where I go in the world, I gotta flap that thing out, slap it down, and they're gonna go, "Yes, citizen of the United States of America." But have you not seen, when you traveled overseas, some folks that you went, "Oof, we call them ugly Americans. Their passport stamp, it says citizen of the United States of America, but it's like everyone who is goes, ooh." You know, they're the ones that are demanding and obnoxious and smacking gum and the cameras around the neck and pushing people and won't stand in line and complaining and griping about the water or the temperature of the water or the lack of ice or a thousand other things. Yeah, they got their passport stamped. They're a citizen of the United States of America, but oh, they ain't acting like it. That is the kind of situation that we face in our study. We're in that book called With, and we're to the lesson called A Life for God. We've looked at life under God, we've looked at life over God, we've looked at life from God, and today's lesson is life for God. And I have to tell you, out of all of the four positions that Sky makes a big deal about, this is the one I wince the most. And my guess is that most people within the sound of my voice have trouble with this one. You may have trouble with a couple of the others too. But this is one we're prolific at. See, the problem is we all believe that our salvation came by grace. But now that we got it, we gotta earn it. We gotta sustain it. We gotta make sure God's really happy with us. I get that my salvation was entirely rooted in grace, that Jesus accomplished it all. Jesus paid it all. But now I gotta make sure that God stays happy with me. I understand I got a passport. But now it's based on my behavior. Am I an ugly American, or am I someone that you know, the powers that be would be proud to say, yes, that's an American citizen? Somehow in our hearts, we get salvation came by grace, entirely by Christ. It was a gift of God, Ephesians 2, not of works, lest any man should boast. I get it. However, he might not be too happy with me today because... Okay, you're all nodding your head, so I'm in good company. Here's the quote that I got out of our book. It says, we all believe that God is, quote, disappointed with me because of my ongoing struggles with some behavior. He expects more from me. And he cannot use me to accomplish his work in the world until I clean up my act. Where do we get that? Think about that in your own salvation experience. I'm, 45 years or so of walking with the Lord. Where did I get that? You know where I got it? Was in church. I got it from people like me. I got it from people who rightly taught that salvation was by grace, but then they quickly went on to say, and now that you got the passport, here are the things you do to prove you're really an American. Or in our case, a Christian. What tended to happen is, again, a quote from him, is what matters is not God's love for us, but how much we now can accomplish for him. It's the buck up and get it done. And if you're a good Christian, you get a lot done. I was with my brothers, as you know, last weekend in New Orleans, and sometime when the microphone's not on, I'll tell you stories, but... it was quite a 3 days, I gotta tell you. It was both a lot of fun and a not so lot of fun. But I was thinking about my father in the midst of it, and one of my dad's famous quotes was, us worlds are not average. We're either above average or below average, but we ain't average. Okay, kind of a subtle message and not so subtle. Does that send to 3 overachieving kids who become overachieving adults? You know, good ain't good enough. Either fail miserably, you know, go down in flames, which all 3 of us have done in varying ways, or overachieve like mad. And that same kind of message kind of comes out in this life for God. What happens is that ministries tend to get focused on taking the person who by grace got salvation. They understood it came by Jesus Christ, not by their works. But once they got that, then there's a message that there's a, okay, we've got to move now from this kind of early Christian experience. We have to move on now and start living for God. We've got to quit being a consumer. We take those verses that you needed milk, not meat. You need to move from milk and move to meat. You got to stop being a taker and start being a giver. You got to stop being a consumer and start being a provider. We need people in the nursery. Don't just take and drop your kids off. You share in the responsibility. Come on. Tuesday nights, we're going out. The really good ones come out Tuesday and Thursday night. If you're really committed, you'll get in a small group. I mean, true? Think of the largest church in our area that will remain unnamed. Do you not immediately think of a baseball diagram? And you start, and you move to first base, and that's good. But boy, you don't want to stay on first base. That's only a single. You need a double. And so you do whatever it is you got to do to go from first base to second base. And that's really good, and a double's good. But wouldn't a triple be better? And so you perform whatever it is to become a triple. And then we want a home run. Do you not want to be a home run? Us Christians are not average. We're either above average or below average because you want a home run. And so you do whatever it is you got to do to get around the bases. I'm not making fun of that. Yes, I am. I'm making fun of it because I'm a proponent of it. I do it. I talk about it. I live it. I'm making fun, and there's nothing wrong with the stuff that's involved with moving from first base to second base or third base. The issue is the motive. Why? You know, we talk about turning the consumers into servants. Or maybe the church might use the expression, we don't want an inward-thinking church. We want an outward-thinking church. Anything wrong with being an outward-thinking church? Of course not. But again, the issue is motive. When I was with my brothers, one of them said to me, "Hey, Brianna's not answering my texts." And I said, "She's not answering mine. Why don't she answer yours?" And so we had a laugh about, you know, 22-year-olds and their lack of communication and whatever. And I was thinking a little bit later about, you know, when she was little, and one of my the members of my family would send her a card or some birthday present or a Christmas present. Of course, I, you know, taught her how to write thank you notes and send them back. And at one point she said to me, oh, I've got to write him a note. And I said, "Yes, you do." And she goes, "No, but if I don't, he won't send me anything else." And I thought to myself, problem here. Right activity, wrong motive. Yes, you should be communicating. And I thought that when Chris told me she wasn't answering texts, I thought, I gotta get on her. If she wants to have a relationship with him, she needs to whatever. And I thought of that when she was little. She got the activity. I need to stay in touch so he'll keep sending me the, you know, Starbucks cards or whatever. Don't you and I do that with the Lord? It's the idea we need to stay in touch with God, so he'll keep blessing. Rather than I need to stay in touch with God because I want to stay in touch with God. Because I want to have a relationship. Whether my uncle sends me another Starbucks card or not, it's important to me to have a relationship with him. Now, what happens with the life for God is focused on a slightly wrong mission. Look at the core. I put in your notes kind of a review of the core of each of these kind of postures that Sky's been teaching us. What's at the heart of life under God? Well, under the external, if you dial down in the position of life under God, the core of it is we want to find the right equation. We want to find just the right ritual, the spiritual thing that we can barter with God. I did this, so you got to do that. I did this, so now I don't have to be afraid. So at the core is trying to find God's will and do it. Not because we want to have a relationship with him, we just want to make sure we've got the equation down. Life over God, what we're really doing there is trying to find predictable principles. Again, we want some control over it. We don't want to feel out of control. We want to have some element. So we're looking for those divine laws or those principles. And once we get them down, we really understand them, we get them knocked, then we have some sense of control. Again, life from God. Now here, the center is me and my needs. It's all about me. And God becomes kind of a vending machine. So at the core of it, it's me. Now life for God, you'd say, well, when you're active doing things for God, isn't God at the center? Unfortunately, no. What often happens is accomplishment of his mission is at the center, not him personally. It's the job. It's the mission. If being effective was kind of the product of life from God, I want to be an effective person, I want to find those principles that work, well, in life for God, accomplishment is the product. Check, I did that. Check, I did that. Check, I'm involved in this. Check, I'm involved in that. Yes, I'm in a leadership position here. Yes, I teach a Bible study. Yes, I'm involved in evangelism effort. Yes, yes, check, check, check. It's accomplishment. It's almost like being a brownie again and getting a badge. I didn't really like brownies. I thought it was kind of dumb. You know, we all got together and they taught us to sew. Well, I was never any good at it. I still can't sew buttons on. That's what staplers are for, you know? Hymns. That's how I got through college, with hymns. I wasn't very good at it. I'm not very fine motor. Didn't happen with me. But I went to brownies, and I was a really good brownie. Anybody want to guess why? The badges. I had more badges than anybody else in my troop. I get them super ones, you know, the really big ones. When you get five of these, you get a big one instead because they got too close. Man, I had the big ones. I just translate that mindset into accomplishing things for God. See, and what Sky's trying to say is that when we're functioning from this position, what really happens is we're trying to make God a little bit beholden to us. Little bit. You know, you owe me a little something here. Didn't I? Da-da-da-da. Wasn't I? Da-da-da-da. Every time the church's doors were open, wasn't I there? They asked for a volunteer. My hand was the first one up. Didn't I this? Didn't I that? Didn't I participate in this? Don't you have a little blessing coming my way? That's at the heart of this problem. So performance trumps relationship. You know, lots of biblical examples, but one that came to my mind is in 1 Samuel 15. Turn to 1 Samuel 15. Very familiar passage. It's unfortunately the chapter where the Lord rejects Saul as the king of Israel. 1 Samuel 15. A little bit of background. God had told Saul to go out and wipe out the Amalekites, I think, Agag, if memory serves me right. So wipe them out. Get rid of them all. We need to make sure that they don't rise up again and bother Israel. And Saul goes and attacks and things happen and, you know, he's met when he comes back. Let's see, let's start with verse 12. Early in the morning, the prophet Samuel got up and went to meet Saul. But he was told Saul has gone to Carmel. There he has set up a monument in his own honor, and has turned and then gone down to Gilgal. When Samuel reached him, Saul said, "The Lord bless you, I have carried out the Lord's instructions." Did it all. Showed up every time the door was open, volunteered for the nursery, gave 10% to everything, a little extra for missions, went on a missions trip or two or three, was involved in everything I could do, everything that the church suggested, everything that a leader wanted an involvement, my hand went up. But Samuel said, verse 14, "Really? What then is the bleating of the sheep in my ears?" He was supposed to kill everything off, bring back nothing, wipe them out. And the prophet goes, "Really? You did all that? I hear some sheep and I hear some cattle. Where'd that come from?" Saul answers and says, "Oh, well, and me. The soldiers, they brought them back from the Amalekites. They must have spared the best of the sheep and the cattle. But they did it for a really good reason. To sacrifice to the Lord." Man, they were bringing back the good stuff. The good sheep, the good cattle. This is going to make great sacrifice. Verse 16. Salmon screams, "Enough! Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night." Saul says, "Tell me. Although you were once small in your own eyes, did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel. He sent you on a mission saying, 'Go and completely destroy these wicked people, the Amalekites. Wage war against them until you wipe them out.' Why did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord?" "But I did obey the Lord," Saul said. "I went on the mission the Lord assigned me. I completely destroyed the Amalekites and I brought back Agag, their king. The soldiers, they took sheep and cattle from the plunder, the best of what was devoted to God, in order to sacrifice them to the Lord your God at Gilgal." Samuel replied, "Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifice as much as in obeying the Lord?" "Nice try, Saul." "No parting gifts. You leave. No longer king." Why? Because he got it mixed up. He thought that great sacrifices, best of the sheep, best of the cattle, aren't I doing a good thing here? Is it not a good thing to have an offering for the Lord? Sure. Good cattle, good sheep, yeah. Good mission, yeah. But it wasn't what he asked for. He asked for obedience. The problem with the life for God is that we're trumping relationship with something else that is indeed good, but not the best. Serving the Lord is a good thing. Involvement in church is a good thing. Teaching, serving, giving, loving others, all a good thing, but not for the purposes of making sure we get a Starbucks card from God. Relationship is the issue. Turn to Ephesians chapter 3 for a New Testament look. Because even the pursuit of accomplishing or doing the mission of God cannot, should not, must not replace a relationship with Him. We need to be filled with what Paul in Ephesians 3 calls the fullness of God. Ephesians chapter 3, verse 14 to 19. This is part of a prayer that Paul is praying for the church at Ephesus. He says, "For this reason I kneel before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth derives its name. I pray that out of his glorious riches he may strengthen you with power through his Spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith. And I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, may have power together with all the Lord's holy people to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ, and to know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God." It is about relationship. It is about knowing how high and how wide and how deep and how long is the loving relationship with Christ. Not confusing our mission or our tasks with the relationship he wants to have with us. And I wrote a phrase down. It's a little bit different than in the book, but it is a highlighted phrase. It's going on a card in my office. It says, "We cannot confuse our calling with our treasure." Our calling is not enough. And those of us that are in quote full-time service, this is disease we get, and then we pass it along. We make it sound like this is it. If you're really serving the Lord, you're at the apex, the pinnacle. Ooh, God is happy with you. Back to motive. Serving, yes. Caring, yes. Giving, yes. Doing, yes. For what reason? If you miss out on the treasure in pursuit of a calling, you blew it. In our culture, we are really focused on this business about calling. As a Christian, I have a call on my life. Yeah? Newsflash, so do you. So does everyone who's been blessed by the gift of salvation. But there's almost an A crowd, a B crowd, and a C crowd in Christendom. It's kind of like when I was in Bible college. You know, there were really only two things if you were going to accomplish anything for God. You married a missionary, A crowd. You married a pastor, B crowd. And C, you worked in a Christian school. I got the C crowd. In Christendom, we do the same thing. You know, the A crowd is the ones who, I don't know, teach in Sunday school or lead a small group or, you know, are on Thursday nights for some activity or something. You know, and then the B crowd is, they're on the, you know, substitute list for helping in Sunday school. And the C crowd are the consumers who just sit and take. And the motivation is to move from C to B. And if you're really, really good, you move from B to A. Again, nothing wrong with the activities. We all should be involved. We all should do our share of the effort and work that it takes for churches and ministries to go forward. But it's motive. It's relationship. You know, Matthew chapter 7, turn with me. This is the worst verse in the Bible, in my opinion. If I were cutting one out, this is it. You know, Martin Luther took the book of James out of his Bible. He was so focused on the just shall live by faith that when he looked at the book of James and it talked a lot about your faith is shown by your works, he said, oh, this can't be in the Bible, and literally cut it out, tore it out, just tore James out. And his Bible didn't have the book of James. Well, in my Bible, Matthew chapter 7, verses 22 and 23 are missing. Not really, but I'd like them to be. Start with verse 21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me, and on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And in your name, didn't we not drive out demons? And in your name, didn't we perform many miracles? And then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. Wow. Motive. All that good activity, all that driving out of demons and all that performing miracles and all that prophecy, and in the end he looks at you and says, I don't know you, take a hike. The problem is if we're not careful in a life focused on doing things for God, our mission becomes an idol. Last week we talked about an idol can be anything that substitutes our place of focus and worship on God himself. And our mission, our function, our work for God can become an idol. There's certainly been periods and times in my life when that was true. My motivation was so messed up that had the Lord actually come down and had a conversation face to face with me, he might have said, what are you doing, moral? Kid, take a hike. An idol is anything. It can be a good thing. It can be a medium thing. It can be a bad thing. But it can be anything that takes our worship away from the Lord. Serving in the nursery is a good thing. But it needs to be done for the right reason. You serve in the nursery because you remember when you had little kids, and it would have been nice if on a Sunday morning you could sit beside your husband and actually for 45 minutes act like an adult. It would have been so nice. And so you took your darling down the hallway and you handed him to some nice lady who gave up her morning to listen to 15 screaming kids so you could sit and actually sing and worship and act like an adult. And when you pick your kid up, they were happy and it was good and you were happy. So now you don't have little kids anymore, so you go work in the nursery. And that poor haggard woman that comes in, you take the kid from her and you listen to him scream for 45 minutes knowing she's getting a break. She's getting a moment. That's why you work in the nursery. Not to get another badge. You know? Our spiritual self-esteem cannot be found in accomplishment. It has to be found in relationship. I just finished reading through Acts in my own devotional time, and I got to Acts 16. If you're not familiar with it, turn there, but if you know the story... In Acts chapter 16, Paul shows up in Philippi. And once he gets there, things go from bad to worse in terms of their response. And verse 16 of Acts 16 says, once we were going to the place of prayer, we were met by a female slave who had a spirit by which she predicted the future, and she earned a great deal of money for her owners, and they have this big whatever, and a crowd comes up in verse 22 and attacks, and then the magistrates, they're seeing the mess that's going on here, they order them to be stripped and beaten with rods in Acts 16:22. And after they had been severely flogged, they were thrown into prison. And the jailer was commanded to guard them carefully. And then when he received these orders, he put them in the inner cell and he fastened their feet in the stocks. Now, mental picture here, Paul, his crowd, they are now in prison. Their feet are in stocks. How much are they accomplishing? What are they getting done for God? Daytimer's out. Now we do them on our phones. Four S's are out. Blackberries are humming. What are they doing? What are they getting done for God? How's their mission moving forward? What are they accomplishing? Zip, zero, nada. So are they not in the will of God? They're dead center in the will of God. They choose instead to have a little prayer service and a little praise service. You and I know what happens. Verse 25, about midnight, a little late for me, but they're up. It's a little hard to sleep standing up. Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God. And the other prisoners were listening to them. Mission field happened to be in the cell next door. And through their time of singing and praising God, and no doubt Paul's doing a little preaching, suddenly we have an earthquake, the place falls down, he leaves, the jailer gets saved, his family gets saved, Philippi has a church started, and it moves on. But my challenge, my question to you is, if their self-esteem was an accomplishment, and I'm betting you Paul was kind of like that, got places to go, people to see, churches to start, things to do, and he finds himself in stocks in a prison. But that was God's plan. And their focus was on relationship. Singing, praying, talking to the guy in the cell next door. Our spiritual self-esteem cannot be focused on accomplishment. There was a little quote in his book on missionalism. It's a great little word. It says, missionalism starts slowly and gains a foothold in the leader's attitude. Before long, the mission controls almost everything. The time, the relationships, the health, the spiritual depth, the ethics and the convictions. And in advanced stages, missionalism means doing whatever it takes to solve the problem. In its worst iteration, the end always justifies the means. The family goes, health is sacrificed, integrity is jeopardized, and God connection is limited. If there aren't 15 nationally known pastors that pop into your head right then, you're not listening. And that's what happens. Because the mission becomes everything. Now you say, well, I'm not a national leader. No, but in your own life, in your own scope, in your own church, in your own ministries, in your own family, is relationship center place? Or are we somehow trying to get the brownie badges again? Are we somehow working for God and subtly then expecting a little return? I shouldn't be so fearful. Why is my family struggling with this? Didn't we? Aren't we? Haven't I always? Again, it's another subtle kind of quid pro quo. I stock the bank with my mission, my service, my ministry. Isn't there a little return expected here? And therefore, can I have a little control over the things that frighten me? I don't know. It made me think, and our author draws this conclusion, to the older brother in Luke 15. Turn to Luke 15. You know this story very well. We call it the story of the prodigal son. And chances are the 50 million times you've heard that story, that parable taught, you know, someone has told you that there is a context here, and there is. There's the parable of the lost sheep, and then a parable of the lost coin, and then we get to the parable of the lost son. And we focus on the boy who came to his dad before his father passed away and arrogantly asked for his inheritance. Very selfish brother who said, I want it, and I want it now. And most of us could tell the story in great detail about the younger brother. But what about the older brother? I'm not going to read the whole story. I think you know the story well enough. Let's just get down to maybe verse 22. The father's been outside. He's been looking. He sees his son coming, the younger son, back. The Bible says when he came to his senses, he headed home. Father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on it. Put a ring on his finger, sandals on his feet. Bring the fatted calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. We all know that story. Okay, verse 25. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. And so he called one of the servants and he asked him, hey, what the heck is going on? The servant says, well, your brother's come home. Yay! Your father killed the fatted calf. We're having a party. He's come back safe and sound. Older brother goes, yay! I'm so glad my brother came to his senses. Whoopee! Our family's back together. I'm so happy. What does he do? Older brother became angry and refused to go in. So once again, what does the father do? Goes out. Takes the effort, makes the initiative, and pleads with him. But he answered his father and said, look, all these years I have been slaving for you, never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this punk brother of mine, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, come home, you kill the fatted calf for him. Son, father said, you were always with me and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because your brother of yours was dead. He's alive now. He's lost and he's found. Who's the prodigal son here? There are two of them. One of them is the outright selfish brother. The other is the self-centered brother. The brother who was very busy earning his father's affection by his behavior. Neither one of them had a meaningful relationship with their father. The one said, stick it, and took off. The other one said, I'm doing just what I ought to do. It's all coming to me. Look at me. I'm performing. I'm doing just what dad wants. That old scum, he took off, but I'm here. I get up every day. I do my thing. And at the moment when the father chooses to bless the younger son, then his arrogance comes out. Wait a minute. I'm the good guy here. Look what I have done. And clearly the father has to go to him, confront him, talk to him about relationship. You know, I'm not sure which of the two boys is the worst prodigal son. We hear lots of testimonies about the first son, even in our own circles. We don't hear a lot of testimonies about the older brother. We don't hear popping up in our testimony times at church, I'm the older brother in Luke 15. I've been trying to earn God's favor. I've been sucking up. I've been kissing up. I've been trying to get brownie buttons with God for years. We don't hear very much of that. But there's a lot of it in us, if we're honest. You know, I think Sky is really bringing a focus, whether he's talking about life over or with or from or now for. In all of those postures, what he's trying to say is that I am your Heavenly Father. I want to have a relationship. I want it real. Yeah, service, good. respond. Yes, mission, good. Calling, do it. But always because we have a relationship, not because you're trying to earn something. Because you and I both understand we earn nothing. My position with Christ has, or my position with God has not changed since 9:30 at night on September the 3rd, 1969. It's still by grace. Don't matter how many badges. They don't count. Let's pray. Lord, there's so much in this to think about. So much of the older son in all of us that especially have been in ministry in one capacity or another over the years. It's a good time to stop and think about motive. The purpose is not to stop serving or caring or reaching out or giving or participating. The issue is to check our motives. To recognize that really all you want is for all of those activities to provide a way for us to hang with you. To look into your face and call you Father. And to know that at some point, this part of life will be over and we won't have to struggle with that anymore. And in the meantime, we get to hang. So Father, I pray that we would apply it, that I personally today would think about my relationship with you. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.